Okay. Well, I'm going to start by asserting something that's been a recurring theme throughout the entirety of this conference. Capitalism is an unjust and utterly unfair system that cannot be reformed and that needs to be smashed by a workers' revolution. And if this wasn't obvious to people a year ago, I think that all of the huge bailouts of the rich, all the huge bailouts of the financial system give you literally trillions of reasons to want to bring the system down and tear it up root and branch. So how do we do this? In this talk, I'm going to be arguing that whilst a revolutionary party is not required for workers' revolutions to happen, revolutions in fact happen because of the contradictions inherent to capitalism, I'm going to argue that a revolutionary party is required if such a revolution is going to be successful. Without such a party, the ruling class will have free rein to smash the revolution and to drown it in blood, as they've done throughout history, for example, in Chile in 1973, or to divert workers' anger and into support for radical-seeming pro-capitalist parties, and then, when they're off their guard, to crush them. In short, we need to be organised because our opponents, those that want to keep capitalism intact, are organised. One more point I'll elaborate briefly on later as well is that a revolutionary socialist organisation is not something that is just useful in the throes of revolution. And this is precisely because, you know, socialists have no concern about, you know, the profitability of the bosses, no concern for what capitalism claims it can or cannot afford. And we don't limit our strategies to what is acceptable, what is acceptable under capitalism. And so as a result, even in far from revolutionary times, revolutionaries are usually the best fighters for reforms. So these are some of the key points I'm going to be elaborating on throughout this talk. Now I want to cover these points in much more depth. And I want to start with the key question, I think, which is why we need a revolutionary party during times of revolution. So now I'm going to look at several reasons why a revolutionary party is needed in the context of a revolutionary period. Firstly, I'm going to discuss lessons that can be drawn by contrasting the July Days incident that occurred during July 1917 in Russia in the midst of the Russian Revolution, contrasting that to the Spartacus Days in Germany in 1919. Now, don't worry if you sort of thought that the July Days was the name of the stocktake sale at David Jones, or if you thought that the Spartacus Days were 2,080 years ago and occurred in Rome. I'm going to start by explaining what these historical events were. And if you want to read more on these events, I strongly recommend a couple of books. One by Sandra Bloodworth, The Real History of the 1917 Russian Revolution, and The Lost Revolution by Chris Harmon about Germany, both available on our bookstall. Firstly, the Spartacus Days, which were named after the Spartacus League, the revolutionary organisation that had formed in the throes of revolution in Germany in 1918. Now, in November 1918, revolution broke out in Germany, ending both the centuries-old monarchy and ending the First World War. This revolution brought to power a government that was dominated by the majority social democrats, the Social Democratic Party, or SPD, as I'll refer to them. They're basically a German party that were radical reformists. Think what people that like the Labour Party imagine the Labour Party used to be like. This is what the SPD were actually like. So think of someone who loves Gough Whitlam, thinks he's, you know, fantastic. Imagine what they think of Whitlam, and that's to some extent what this party were like. They were sort of radical, but thought that you could change things within the system. Now, so this party dominated the government that formed after the revolution. But at the same time, there were a few more radical people that had key positions within the new government, including Emil Eichhorn, the chief of police, who'd been a long-time radical, well to the left of the new government. And the Social Democrats were worried about growing opposition forming to themselves on the left, and they organised a provocation to try to crush those that wanted to not just end the monarchy, but also wanted to end capitalism as well. On the fourth day of 1919, they sacked Eichhorn, which enraged the working class of Berlin, who realised, you know, this was an attack not just on the police chief, but on them. And it led to a protest of 200,000 people the next day, followed by an attempt by the Spartacus League, which was in the process of renaming itself the German Communist Party, it would lead to an attempt by them to organise an armed insurrection. But while the working class were ready to protest the dismissal of Eichhorn, they were not ready to take part, by and large, in such an insurrection. The revolutionaries were able to be isolated by the government and crushed. And many of them, including Rosa Luxemburg, who was the most important socialist leader in Germany, and another leading socialist, Karl Liebknecht, were hunted down and assassinated. Now, the key thing here is that this party, the Spartacus League, was extremely recently formed. And as a result, they didn't have the authority within the working class to hold things back. But more importantly, they didn't have the roots in the working class to be able to see that actually the majority of workers were not ready, as they thought, were not ready to take part in such an armed insurrection against the government. And so as a result, by provoking the uprising, the government was able to achieve everything that it wanted. Basically, they were able to isolate and, temporarily isolate and crush the revolutionaries. And it was largely because the revolutionaries didn't have the organisation to realise that that they weren't popular enough. They didn't have the support for this action. But also, those that did have the cooler heads and could work out what was going on didn't have the influence to hold things back. Now, I want to contrast this to a similar situation 18 months earlier that occurred in Russia, where the Revolutionary Bolshevik Party, that had been much longer established, had existed for well over a decade, was also faced with the very likely possibility of a premature uprising. So the July days occurred a few months after the Russian monarchy had been overthrown by the February Revolution of 1917. Now, initially, a lot of workers had thought, quite naively as it turned out, that this would mean an end to the hell of World War I, but of course the new capitalist government continued the war and continued all of the suffering, all of the privation, and all of the profiteering that went along with the war. And after months of betrayal by this provisional government, by July, the majority of the working class in just the capital, in just Petrograd, wanted to tear the head off the system of capitalism and bring down the government. And so to this end, they planned to organise, quite a lot of militants planned to organise armed anti-government demonstrations for early July. Now, this might sound, pretty promising for revolutionaries. You've got, huge sections of the working class want to tear the head off the system. They're sick of everything that this capitalist government has been feeding them for months. But there's a major problem. The working class in Petrograd were sharply radicalising, but this was not the case for the rest of the country. And in particular, the peasantry and the soldiers were yet to decisively break from the provisional government. And had the working class in Petrograd actually launched an insurrection, yeah, they might have been able to take power in the city, but they would have been isolated and crushed by the National Russian Army. And so the dangers, to some extent, were the same as Germany. But the key difference in Russia was the Bolshevik Party. The Bolsheviks had been built up over years and years and contained many experienced revolutionaries that had the capacity to assess that the situation in July was not as favourable as they thought. As it may have appeared. They were able to recognise that it was not possible for the working class to come to power across the whole country at this time. Equally importantly, though, they were deeply rooted in the working class and respected by many radical workers that were not card-carrying Bolsheviks themselves. And this gave them the authority to lead an orderly retreat from the early flare-ups during the July days. In fact, one of the most galling tasks that revolutionaries sometimes face in this sort of period is being able to, win arguments to sort of hold struggles back and prevent premature uprisings that would only be destroyed. It's a task that the large, experienced, respected and organised party of the Bolsheviks were up to, but it was one that the German revolutionaries, unfortunately, were not, primarily because they were just simply too inexperienced as an organisation to act decisively to prevent the disaster of the Spartacus days. And even if they'd got things right, they didn't have the influence to actually be able to hold things back. So the second key reason that I want to elaborate on as to why revolutionary organisations Anita during a period of revolution is so that all the forces that support a workers' revolution can act together in a united and decisive way to bring it about. For the example here, I want to stick to Russia and Germany, but I want to move the clock forward a little bit. So let's start with Russia. 3 months after the July days, it's October 1917, and the revolutionary mood is no longer isolated to Petrograd. It wasn't just the workers of Petrograd that want to tear the system apart now, but it's also workers in all the other major centres and large and basically the Bolsheviks managed to win a majority in the Soviets, which are the sort of institutions of the revolution. In addition, there have been people that had previously been loyal to the pro-capitalist parties started tearing up their membership cards and joining the Bolsheviks in large numbers. Significant sections of the army now had joined the Bolsheviks or supported them, and Russia's sort of, I guess, equivalent of the modern SAS, the crack Cossack troops, the elite, were starting to, basically lose their desire to fight for the old order and starting to become neutral. Here was the opportunity for a revolution. And because of their real roots in the working class and the authority and the leadership experience that the Bolsheviks had built up over, more than a decade, they were able to, one, sense this, and two, they were able to actually lead an insurrection, to bring down capitalism, bring down the provisional government that supported it, and for the first time in history, to put the working class in charge of a country and electrifying radicals all around the world. On the other hand, let's consider Germany. Now, fast-forwarding the clock a little further here to 1923, and Germany is in such a dire economic and ideological crisis. You had a situation where, one German mark used to be worth about 23 US cents before the war. By 1923, 1 trillion German marks exchange for 23 US cents. So it gives you a bit of a sense, like there's enormous catastrophe in the economy and that workers are bearing the brunt of this crisis. But they've not forgotten the revolutionary mood of 1918 to 1919. And the entire past 5 years that we've skipped over there have been, years and years of bitter class battles, often resulting in fairly large-scale armed clashes between workers' militias on the one hand and the Freikorps on the other, who were a highly trained, ideologically hardened right-wing wing of the military that were used solely to crush workers' dissent and who marched under the symbol of the swastika. Now, during the years of clashes with the Freikorps, an estimated 20,000 had been killed, and I'll return briefly to this later. And I'm just referencing it now to set a bit of a sense of the political scene in 1923. Politics are bitter, politics are serious, and for many, a matter of life and death. But by 1923, things were starting to look more like October 1917 in Russia. The revolutionary mood amongst the working class was every bit as developed, and they wanted generally to tear the head off the system. But when the time was right to strike, when the opportunity came, the inexperienced German Communist Party, which was the organisation that had sort of taken up the mantle of the Spartacus League, they missed the opportunity. Their inexperience had led them to make mistake after mistake over the past 4 years, where they'd veered widely from premature insurrection to passivity, to premature action again to passivity. And in this situation, when the final opportunity came, they missed the opportunity to actually strike and to actually get rid of the system because at this stage they simply misjudged it. They didn't have the experience of leadership that had been built up through struggles over more than a decade. And as a result, and a couple of other factors as well, but they made the crucial mistake of not organising a decisive battle to basically... smash the power of the capitalist state. As a result, they missed the opportunity, and once it was missed, it did not return. Their lack of an ability to accurately gauge the political situation that led to these disasters, and in particular to the devastating mistake of 1923, stemmed from the lack of seriously developed long-term roots in the working class. The KPD simply did not have enough experienced members implanted in various industries that had had years and years of experience in leading struggles and could thus assess what it was possible to achieve. Now, the final reason that I'm going to mention that a revolutionary party is needed in a revolution is to make it possible to respond nationally and immediately to attacks on the working class that happen anywhere. In other words, our opponents are organised, we must be too. And for an example of this, I want to return a couple of years in Germany to the period where the Freikorps were rampaging around the country. And basically, the strategy of the government was to provoke workers' uprisings in one particular city at a time. The Freikorps would then march in, crush any resistance, and then basically march on to the next, you know, to the next town. They'd storm Berlin, crush the workers there. Then industrialists would provoke a fight in Hamburg. The Freikorps would march in, crush the workers there. Then they'd march to Munich. Then they'd return to Berlin. And then they might go to the Ruhr after that. Basically, throughout this whole period, the government was continually provoking workers, and there was not a nationally coordinated response. As a result, the workers that actually did fight back were able to put up heroic resistance, but they were eventually crushed in each and every time. On the other hand, had there been organisation across the entire country, it would have been possible, when the Freikorps attacked one group of workers, to organise resistance across the whole country, to force the Freikorps into 6 or 7 battles at once that they couldn't win. And if that had happened, then this paramilitary group that, you know, were the first people in modern history to carry the swastika, they could have been routed. So to summarise this section, in a revolutionary period, we need a revolutionary party because those that want to protect capitalism are organised. We need organisation to guard against the working class being goaded into premature uprisings, to guard against missing genuine opportunities that arise, and to allow for decisive, coordinated action rather than allowing the ruling class to pick off radicals one by one. We also need it to defeat political rivals. So, for instance, for the working class to be able to be won away from political rivals such as the SPD in Germany and, in countless other examples. I now want to turn to drawing out the qualities that such a revolutionary party needs to be effective. Now, firstly, I think, we're saying it's a revolutionary party. This might come across as pretty obvious, but it needs to be explicitly revolutionary. And this is important because when an actual revolutionary situation comes up, it's the people that are not for revolution are not reliable. So an organisation that has both genuine revolutionaries in it and also, for instance, people like, people that think that the way you change the world is by voting for the Labour Party or by taking over the Labour Party, such an organisation goes to water when a revolutionary period hits. Secondly, an organisation needs to be politically clear in order to be able to ideologically defeat its opponents, the various political currents that want to defend the status quo, for example, our very own ALP. It needs to organise, though, I think this is important, it needs to organise the most class-conscious minority, the most radical minority of the working class. And the reason for this is a phenomenon that that's termed uneven consciousness, where some workers, basically, there's sort of a whole lot of ideas that people can have in their minds at various times. On the one hand, some people can, accept everything that the bosses say. They can vote, they can be workers and they can vote for the Liberal Party. They can scab on strikes. They can, very much shy away from being a member of a union. And on the other hand, you have workers that are much more to the left that can basically identify that, they hate the system, they hate the way they're exploited at work, and can actually be, can genuinely be left-wing. And the important thing here is that we need to organise the minority that actually are on the left, the vanguard, if you like, the people that are the most class-conscious. And that sort of comes about because of the needs for political clarity. Some of the other things that such a party needs, it needs to learn and earn the ability and the authority to lead. And this takes time. A revolutionary organisation needs to have many, many people indeed that are capable of, you know, that have learned through being involved in strikes in the past, through being involved in various other political campaigns in the past, have learned how to make a political argument in order to be able to actually, to be able to convince people. It needs to be able to, it needs to be able to also have the authority to lead by having built up trust amongst the working class over a long period of time. So, for instance, the Bolsheviks, when they wanted to argue for a particular course of action, they could turn back and say, or they could turn around to a detractor and say, well, look at the time that there was a, there was a revolution in 1905. We were on the right side back then, so you can trust us now. You know, they could use that to actually get, they gain some credibility out of being experienced and being correct in the past. In addition, revolutionary party or organisation serves as the memory of the class. Basically a revolutionary party can learn the lessons of past defeats that the working class have suffered and also can draw lessons out from victories as well. You can then, a revolutionary organisation can then ensure or can do its best to ensure that the mistakes are not repeated and the successes are. As well as this, during periods when the political climate turns against the working class, a revolutionary party can keep alive some of the most important political lessons even when everyone else deserts them. And the Bolsheviks in 1907 are a good example of this. The 1905 revolution has been defeated, and now there is a wave of reaction sweeping across Russia. During this period, the Bolsheviks, sure, they lost a lot of members during this period, but they were able to keep alive the political idea that you needed to have a revolution to overthrow the system. They were able to keep these ideas alive even when a whole lot of people that might have, you know, been on the right side of the barricades 2 years earlier had suddenly recanted and said, oh, no, we had nothing to do with that, that basically start deserting as soon as they become less popular. I now want to turn to why this party needs to be built before a revolution. And I think, Germany is a really clear example of this. There were people trying to build revolutionary organisations in Germany. They started way too late. And the disaster here was that, even though there were, early on, there were a few thousand people involved in the Spartacus League, about 3,000 involved at the time of 1919 during the Spartacus days, this organization was simply not big enough or experienced enough because, unlike the Bolsheviks, which had been, building since 1903 in Russia, they basically hadn't had the time to seriously lay roots in the working class and to seriously, develop a layer of people that could effectively lead. And so as a result, when the shit hit the fan, they didn't have the experience to, basically all their building work had come too late. And, if you want an analogy for that, it's too late to install a smoke alarm in your house once it's already burning down. You can see similar examples, and I'd encourage people beyond the scope of this talk to really go into them in depth, but more recent examples have occurred in France in 1968, and I'd encourage people to have a read of either of these books about that, and also in Iran in 1979, where scattered radicals have just been unable to defeat political opponents in the case of Iran, in an actual revolution, and in 1968 in France, in a potentially revolutionary situation, radicals that had come together found that they were banging their heads against a brick wall. In France, the Communist Party had immense authority amongst the working class, and they were able to sell a sellout in the end because the genuinely revolutionary people didn't have the organisation to have, meetings in factories and, basically to have someone in every factory saying, down with this sellout, why are we going to accept this offer, this compromise, when we can bring the government down? And likewise in Iran, The genuinely revolutionary people there came up against two forces, both the forces of the Stalinist parties and also the forces of the Ayatollahs. And they were basically unable to deal with these pressures that they came up against. It takes time to develop the ability to correctly judge situations, the ability to act decisively. It takes time to develop serious roots in the working class and to judge the mood of the working class and to judge whether or not people are prepared to go to a demonstration or whether that's, you know, something that people aren't going to be prepared to do, whether it's possible to organise a general strike or not. And in addition, it takes time to develop the influence in the working class to be able to carry arguments, to be able to actually win key political arguments. Okay, I just want to really briefly touch on why revolutionaries are the best fighters for reforms outside of a revolutionary period. Now, as I said before, we don't limit ourselves to the tactics that the system can accept or to fighting for demands that capitalism can afford. And so, for instance, you see there's all sorts of political struggles where a whole lot of forces that genuinely do want to say, for instance, with work choices, a whole lot of the people that genuinely did want to see work choices utterly torn up, like a lot of the, some of the union officials that ended up throwing their weight behind the Your Rights at Work campaign that ended up being a Vote One Kevin Rudd campaign. And in the end, this strategy of, basically not calling everyone out on strike, not bringing the country to a halt, but instead channeling it into safe channels, that was something that the system could tolerate. Whereas going beyond that to, say, organising a general strike. Now, I'm not saying that people that aren't revolutionaries can't organise general strikes. Sometimes they do. But they're much more hesitant to use the full power of the working class. I think the other thing, though, that's really important is that revolutionaries know which toes to step on and who are reliable allies, because we understand the way that the system works, the class nature of capitalism. And it's so for this reason revolutionary parties end up being more the collective memory of the class. And I love this. It's not my analogy, but basically I've heard the reformist parties referred to as the collective amnesia of the class, forgetting all the lessons of the past, and because ultimately they're not fighting for the same goal that we are. So it's important to say now that Socialist Alternative in 2009 is not such a, not such a revolutionary party in the sense that, we're not even the size that the Spartacus League were at the start of, the start of the German Revolution. What we're trying to do, what our project is to lay the foundations for building such a party in the future. And I'm going to suggest here that people read... I'm going to suggest here that if people want to read more about this, Mick Armstrong's book, From Little Things, Big Things Grow, is an excellent excellent source for more than I can go into in just a couple of minutes in this talk about this topic. But some of the sorts of activities that Socialist Alternative does today, I think it's worth putting these in the context of the sort of organisation that we want to build in the future. So people have probably noticed, you have a look around the room at this conference or at one of our meetings, you probably see we're about half to three-fifths students. And building a base on the campuses, a small but significant area of work where we can have an influence, our decisions matter and have consequences, basically helps us to gain the ability to lead even in just a small area of work, and at the same time, experience in gaining the authority to lead struggles that, in the future will be much more important. Likewise, our intervention into political campaigns, such as the campaign against the war on Gaza, the campaign that I've, been involved in for several years particularly during the Howard years, of the campaign to free the refugees. But also there's the sort of more, propagandistic type work that we do, where we're trying, you know, I mean, basically we need to grow numerically because, you know, we're trying to lay the foundations for a big party in the future. But in addition, there's the sorts of things that, you know, people have no doubt been asked to do if you're members of Socialist Alternative, or you've seen us doing if you're not, such as holding meetings, attending information stalls and the like. I think it's worth saying that these sorts of things push us to learn to win political arguments and to learn how to convince people of socialist ideas. You know, our meetings help organise us, but also our meetings help to give us a political understanding of both the world as it is and some of the key lessons from history. Some of the key lessons from history that we want to be, that's important for us, you know, to not repeat some of the mistakes of the past. Likewise, our stalls give us experience in winning political arguments with people, in figuring out how to pitch them, and as such, give us the sort of experience that a revolutionary organisation of the future will need. But I now want to conclude, given that I've gone 3 minutes over what I intended to go, and basically by saying the horrors of the world today that we've been talking about this whole conference pose very sharply a question: which side are you on? And picking sides is the first step. It's a very important step. But the key to actually winning is organisation. As Trotsky put it, he likened the sort of role of a revolutionary party to the role of a steam engine, when he said that, you know, the working class is like the steam. The revolutionary party is like, the box, and the steam dissipates into nothing unless you've got a box. But it's not the box that moves the engine, that moves the piston, but it's the steam. And, you know, if the box is made of cardboard, then you end up with a horrible mess. And so, you know, politics are very important here. The cost of this question of getting the question of organisation wrong in the past, of the political mistakes of past generations of activists, have been immense. And all you need to do is look at the descent into barbarism that occurred in Germany in the 20-odd years after 1923, where basically the ruling class had their revenge. They took the swastika away from, you know, just the the small bands of Freikorps, and made it the national symbol. And there were, you know, basically, people can look up a history book if you want to see just how horrific the actual human cost of these political mistakes of not being organised was. History shows us that revolutions will happen, whether there are revolutionaries or not. But history shows us that revolutions without revolutionary parties present get defeated, as some other force, maybe a Labour Party, maybe a moderate Stalinist party, maybe something else, misleads the working class, misdirects their rage and their power to help themselves and to help capitalism stay intact. And just as it's too late to put the umbrella up when you've been walking out in the pouring rain for half an hour, it might make you feel a little less stupid, but you're still going to get sick, we can't wait for the barricades to go up. We need to build this sort of organisation now. And I want to finish with the words of Thanasis Kokoulis, who was here, spoken at this conference a few times, when he said, "What we need to do is turn our anger into organised power."